I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. Over the past 4 years, this podcast has featured a number of examples of countries that cherry-pick from the past to feel better about themselves in the present. Poland offers one of the most glaring examples of what Canadian historian Jan Grabowski refers to as Holocaust distortion. Prior to the Second World War, Poland had the largest Jewish population in Europe, and during the Holocaust, more Jews died in Poland than anywhere else in Europe. Of Poland's 3 million pre-war Jewish population, only 1% survived. Through his extensive field research, Jan Grabowski has documented that this simply couldn't have happened without the collusion of the general Polish population. Yet for years, Polish authorities have labored tirelessly to turn the story of Jewish victimization into a story of Polish victimization, even Polish heroism. This is a story you simply have to hear to believe. As always, if you value the content of this podcast and want to hear more like it, share a link with a friend or family member, subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast app, and review us wherever you can. A conversation with University of Ottawa historian Jan Grabowski about his book, Whitewash, Poland and the Jews, in this episode of Realms of Memory.
My name is Jan Grabowski, and I am a professor of history of the Holocaust at University of Ottawa in the Department of History. I have been working on issues related to basically to the extermination of Polish Jewry and Polish Jewish contacts and so on for last close to 30 years. And the book that I would like to discuss with you today is It's actually first edition was like this. It was in Australia, then it's now in out of Toronto University Press in Canada. And also in between, there was a Polish edition last November. So basically, the book is called Whitewash, Poland and the Jews. So this is the object of our discussion, I believe.
Jan, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you begin your book with a lecture in Warsaw in 2023 that went horribly wrong. There was a turn of events that caught you by surprise. Can you paint a picture of what happened?
Right. I mean, the thing is that given that I have been working on Polish-Jewish relations, which is always a very touchy topic in Poland, we'll get into it later on, I am not very frequently invited to speak in Poland. I'm invited in very many other jurisdictions, countries, and continents even, but not in Poland. So I was very happy to actually accept an invitation from my colleagues working at the German Historical Institute, which is a very noble institution in the downtown Warsaw, to deliver a lecture about Polish problem. I called it Polish problem with growing problems with history of the Holocaust, which was a popular lecture, but also for historical audiences. And what happened basically is that there was a heavy police presence in front of the building, lights flashing, which gave me, you know, a sort of pause. And then during my lecture, I didn't have a chance even to really start my lecture. I barely was through the introduction after 10 minutes. A bearded fellow who I learned was a member of Polish Parliament, he's a member of the European Parliament, his name is Grzegorz Braun, jumped to his feet, crossed the floor, and grabbed microphone away from me, and shouting enough, started to, destroy the microphone and then throw around his weight, throwing down the loudspeakers. As you can easily imagine, chaos broke out. The lecture was over, and a scandal, of course, of international proportions began. I mean, I have been teaching Holocaust for 30 years, but nothing like it has ever happened to me before, although I was at a cutting edge of different controversies in the past. But something to see a rabid anti-Semite actually charge the podium and attack me without the police that were present actually doing anything, basically proved that that this was the issues I raise are indeed very much at this nerve point in Poland. And the reaction later on proved me quite right, unfortunately.
So it seems like the issue at hand, the objection, the main objection was you shining a spotlight on Holocaust distortion in Poland. And could you explain what is that? What's the difference between Holocaust denial and Holocaust distortion?
Look, I mean, Holocaust denial seems to me, from my vintage point, a very benign sin of the past. I mean, it was a group of rather disorganized, strange people who simply questioned the factuality of the Holocaust, something that a reasonable person would reject offhand. Now, distortion is a very more much more insidious animal. It is a twist which basically says that people, and most of all states, because this is not a private individual, let's say a few strange people sending out memos that gas chambers were a word of fiction, but this is powerful European and not only European states involved in this process. The distortion at the basis of distortion of the history of the Holocaust is the idea that, yes, unfortunately, we regret the fact the Jews have been murdered by Nazi Germans between 1939 and 1945. We agree on this, no issue here. However, what the distortionists will say, our people, our group, our tribe, our nation had nothing to do with the fact. And so basically what they do, they offer a somehow impoverished, falsified version of history, because what they say impartially is true. Well, yes, the Germans murdered 6 million Jews during the war. However, what they will not admit is that the Germans had a legion of willing, sometimes very willing, fellow travelers, auxiliaries, helpers, you name them, from France through Netherlands, through Germany, Balkans, all the way to Poland, Russia, Belarus, and Baltic countries, no exceptions. And I mean, this kind of joyful sometimes cooperation, collusion with the Germans, of course, was present in Poland. So this is the problem. If you are dealing with distortionists, they have one leg in the truth, another leg, so to say, in deep in lies. So this is the shortest way I could explain it.
And you stress that Holocaust distortion is especially problematic in Poland. Why is it even more of an issue there? Because Poland is not unique in doing this.
Right. Poland leads the pack, I would say. Why Polish case is, I mean, I have been born, raised in Poland. I have been raised in Polish traditions. So this is something I know by heart from my primary school and secondary school and university. I came to CAD as an adult, finally. So this is a luggage I carried along. So I know this kind of certain obsession with the past. But why Poland is so important? Well, to give you just a few very bullet points. One is Holocaust physically happened in Poland. Okay. I mean, if you look at not all of it, but most of it, if you look at the number of victims of the Shoah, close to 4.7 million out of the six have been put to death on pre-war Polish territory. So basically, Germans not only murdered 3.1 million Polish Jews, which was the largest Jewish community in Europe, second largest in the world after the United States, but also they brought European Jews from all over the place, from Greece, as far away as Greece, or Balkans, and France, and all the other occupied and sometimes non-occupied places, Hungary. And they delivered them to, and this is point number two, to the extermination camps or death sites, whichever places that you know probably most of us have heard, like Auschwitz. Practically probably all had heard about this, and then Treblinka, Bełżec, Majdanek, Sobibór, Kulmhof. All of these areas were located for reasons of expediency. That's where the Jews were, majority Polish Jews. So this is all of these camps where Jews were mass murdered during the the genocide were located on pre-war Polish territory. And point three, all these camps are today on Polish territory, and this has a crucial memorial importance of or commemorative importance. In other words, you don't have any other country that would have to become, and not willingly, so to say, a custodian of the memory of the Holocaust. If you want to go to see Auschwitz, you have to go to Poland, right? And what you will see in Auschwitz or in Treblinka or in any other of these places I mentioned of horrifying Jewish suffering will be the message that the Polish state will allow you to digest, to see, and to receive. So these are just, there is more, of course, but these are perhaps three which make Poland stand out miles ahead of the crowd.
And you point out that you describe the Poles as reluctant custodians of the Holocaust past, that they're stuck with this legacy, with these extermination camps. They got to figure out how to appropriate that past. And one of the ways they do this is they have a lot of institutional resources that they can bring to bear, a lot of legal resources they can bring to bear. So what you spend a lot of time on in your book is describing these institutions devoted to memory, devoted to history, that harness that memory and turn it in a way that's much more favorable to how the Polish government would like to understand its past. So how does that work? What are these institutes? Right. What do they do to distort that past and actually to find a way to give it even a positive charge?
So imagine that the measure of this historical malaise, or perhaps obsession will be more pertinent or better word here. Imagine that, well, Poland is about demographically size of Canada. At this stage, there is an institution which has been, it's called Institute of National Remembrance, which is one of the chief player on this memorial field in Poland, but it's one of the many. But just to give you an idea of their resources, they have now around 3,000 full-time employees. And we are dealing with an institution which is supposed basically to enforce the official line narrative, official state narrative in matters of history. Not only history of the Shoah, of course, not only history of Holocaust, the Polish history and everything that has some kind of a link to Polish history. You have 3,000 full-time employees. Now, I am working at University of Ottawa, which is one of the largest institutions in Canada, spanning here from, you know, physical sciences, chemistry, through all the other parts of human knowledge. We have about one third of this staff, right? So you have 3,000, for the most part, historians, armed with a budget this year of 650 million zlotys, which is about 200 million Canadian dollars at this stage. We are talking serious pennies. And all of this, and enormous research portfolio, extraordinary exhibiting power, in addition to which you have also a question of publications. Who is writing history in Poland? In a large part, people who are not historians, because once you enter these institutions like the Institute of National Remembrance, you are no longer a historian. I mean, historian like I or my colleagues are people who design or create their own field of work. In other words, I decide what I want to do, right? And then I apply for funds in a very tight peer-pressured competition. Usually you don't get these resources, but you try. But the crucial part is you as a historian define your own area of interest and you pursue it. Now, in the case of the state institutions like IPN, the Institute of National Remembrance, you have state budget, which is being released to that institution in order to pursue the goals that the state thinks are necessary, important. So if we want to prove that Poles were, as a society, massively helped the Jews during the war, which is not true, by the way. But if you want to prove it, then you release funds and you will have a few hundred historians working and producing for local consumption. So to give you an example with Institute of National Remembrance, they had their so-called targeted directions of research. One of them was Polish-Jewish relations. One of the crucial ones was Polish-Jewish relations during the war. And the objective basically was to make this story as positive as possible. In other words, to prove beyond any doubt that Polish society did whatever humanly possible to help its Jewish friends and neighbors at the time of need. And of course, the second part of this mandate is to confront people who disagree with the line, with the official party line. So in addition to these different, there are different institutes, Pilecki Institute, there is many of them actually. Important, they are state-funded, state-run, and they, in the case of IPN, they do have inquisitorial, prosecutorial powers. They can go, they have to, and they can also enforce the official narrative in history, and they can, they don't have to pursue legally in front of courts. They can threaten to do it. Usually humanists are very fragile human beings. If you are threatened by a state institution with criminal proceedings, as I was, for instance, or my colleagues also were, then of course you have second thoughts coming to your mind. And if you are an undergraduate student or a graduate student, if you think that you will be confronted with the whole might of the state, you might want to change perhaps your thrust of historical inquiry. So this is the kind of maze and quicksands of memory that you have in Poland with guardians, legal guardians, and also what you have, which you until recently very, very present, it was campaigns of hate against people like myself who were opposing this official narrative. So all of this created this climate, which I try to describe in Whitewash in detail as someone who basically, you know, had and has to deal with this still, with this kind of nonsense.
And there's no version of the American Historical Association that might have autonomy outside of this this institute?
Yes, there are universities and there are special, let's say, think tank institutes. Not so many, but there are. The problem is that in the matters of Polish innocence, as I call it, so we did nothing wrong. This is the big slogan, let's say. Here, unfortunately, Polish right-wing nationalists can find friendly echo outside of their own sphere of direct influence. In other words, people, this belief in own historical innocence, which has been formed in families and then in primary schools, in secondary schools, it's pretty relentless, this kind of historical propaganda. It works and it provides for a common ground where Poles of all political, let's say, inclinations, political opinions meet. A very unique, I would say, meeting ground or narrow bridge upon which the communists, ex-communists, and the centrist Democrats meet far-right nationalists. And this is the so-called defense of the good name of the Polish nation. And the same problem you can see in places like Romania, Hungary, Ukraine. Ukraine is a special case due to their extreme conditions of war today, or the Baltic countries such as Lithuania, most of all. So it's not a Polish phenomenon only, this alliance in defense of the good name of the nation, which trumps your political affiliation. Even if you have a lot of research going on in outside of these state-run institutions, you have, I would say, little in terms of real inquiry into things like collusion, collaboration, and outright participation in the Holocaust by Poles during the time of the Shoah.
So you make a point that if there's this, if Holocaust distortion is anchored in this conviction of about Polish innocence, this isn't just a recent thing. This isn't just a Law and Justice Party phenomenon. It really goes back to the early post-war years. And so it's got roots that go back decades. So where does this begin?
It's actually quite unbelievable, you know, because usually you would think that this reaction to the Holocaust, the memory of the Holocaust, would be somehow related to the great, let's say, growth of Holocaust commemoration at the end of the last century, beginning of this century. No, in Poland, due to these very particular circumstances, it started practically the moment the Shoah was over. And the reason, there were many reasons, but the chief reasons was that one has to understand that Polish non-Jewish, Polish society, Polish ethnic society went through a real hell during the war too. In other words, what you have is the German occupation in Poland was nothing you could compare to let's say, occupation of France or Norway or Denmark or Netherlands. It was a totally different dimension of terror. So the cities were razed to the ground. I mean, Warsaw, a place of my birth, was practically like a piece of on the moon or Mars. It was destroyed in 90% of the buildings have been destroyed. The thing is that in a Polish society emerging out of the war, you had this deep and very justified sentiment of own victimhood. We have been slaughtered, basically, over the years. We lost who knows how many people. And when this, when the and second thing that sort of went along with it, so once is the sentiment of own vulnerability, of own victimhood, very strong and justified. Second is in 1944-45, the Soviets arrive and they impose a political system which the Poles dislike profoundly, which is communism. Communism was never popular in Poland, was always associated with aggressive Russia or Soviet Union, depending on the time. So here, the arrival of a handful of Polish communists who are now basically taking over the country triggers very strong and very vivid anti-Semitic feelings. And as some of you know, and probably you know, according to this to this imaginary world of anti-Semites, there is a very strong association of Jews with Bolshevism, the so-called Judeo-Bolshevism, and Judeo-Commune. So the Poles are now feeling not only suffering because of the occupation that they somehow survived, but also of this new invasion from the east, which very many people interpret as Jewish invasion. Now, the Polish Jews have been slaughtered. Not all of them, however. There are some people trickling back from the east, from the who were, let's say, saved inside the Soviet Union during the war, right? So the thing is that in 1945, Polish authorities start finally to gather the pieces, and they say that, look, we think that we know that there were three, at least 3 million Polish Jews who have been murdered by the Germans. This is quite clear. We have here the data. Practically no one survived. So it's easy. The count is fairly easy. And we think that around 1.8 million ethnic Poles have been put to death in a variety of circumstances between the 39 and 45. Huge number. However, the communist leadership started right away to be very upset with these findings because they feared, probably quite justly, they feared that should they announce that 1.8 million Poles and 3 million Jews have been murdered, that would trigger a sort of a hostile reaction against the communists who are Jews, so they probably lie about insufficient our Polish losses. So the decision, which it sounds crazy, but unfortunately that was it still is the case today. So if you look at, I would say, majority of textbooks dealing with the question, you will see that 6 million Polish citizens died during the war, 3 million Poles and 3 million Jews. This was the idea which has been handed down by Polish leader of chief of Polish secret police, Jakub Berman, in 1945, and it still is the required reading, so to say, despite the fact that we know better. But it sounds right. So this is an early example of something we historians of the Shoah, we call it Holocaust envy, which means that you have to elevate your own suffering to the desired Jewish level. And in the Ukraine, it was very obvious, for instance, a few years back, the research was conducted how many Ukrainians were killed by the Soviet policies of hunger in the early 1930s during the so-called Holodomor. The objective was to get to 6 million. It was quite officially announced. It sounds horrifying, but this competition to reach the level of Jewish suffering has been fueling this distortion and falsification of history of the Shoah for years. And for, you can count from 1945 for last 8 years, because this has been done relentlessly in Poland with a short pause for the night of Stalinist repression between 48 and 50, let's say seven short years. And then again, it started. And there are many different aspects of it, but this distortion is as old as the Holocaust itself, I would say.
But you know, I had an interview with on Ukraine a while back, and the difference there seems to be you get the inflation of the Holodomor as this national tragedy, as a story of victimization within a country that has a long history of that narration, just like Poland does. But that's very much a post-communist narrative. You're rallying around the nation, whereas the Polish case, this is just a carryover from the communist era. It's very different.
There is no, you are right. I mean, this is an interesting point. I mean, in Poland, this is a quite clear. I don't know so well Ukrainian reactions to these numbers. So this is what you mentioned.
The historian I interviewed, he made the point of saying that you get historians who were employed by the communist regime, and they make this seamless transition to basically doing the same thing for the new regime, and that's what shocked him and led to his career writing about memory politics in Poland. I mean, in Ukraine.
In Ukraine. No, this is a very interesting point. And actually, I must tell you that I lectured in Kharkiv a few years before the war started, before the full-scale Russian invasion began. And I was amazed at how much more actually open the Ukrainian graduate and undergraduate students were than what I found in Poland. But I must one thing is quite obvious, that in Poland, issue of complicity in the Holocaust is one of the fundamental historical issues, which is being debated not in the halls of academia and not even on the radio only. It is in private family conversation. This is one of the issues which actually, as one of my Holocaust researcher friends from Poland said, you know, in Poland, everyone is a specialist in soccer and in the Holocaust. And this is built around this particular notion of, you know, us against the world competition in which we cannot lose. So this is there are so many other aspects of it. But one interesting thing that I should add here is that what also makes this Polish case, which I describe in Whitewash, this particular case, is that you need to remember that out of 3 million Polish Jews who had the misfortune, as part of my father, for instance, to find themselves at a certain point under the German rule, out of 3 million plus, 30,000 lived, which gives you an idea. It's 1%, right? I mean, the world has never seen a genocide that complete, that absolute, as in the case. I mean, the nation of Polish Jews with its language, traditions, culture has been annihilated. It doesn't exist anymore. So actually, this is a war that in Poland that Hitler won. And unfortunately, he had to make this And this is what I write about. Some people can call it margins of the Holocaust, is describing how this so perfect system of genocide could see the light of the day.
Yeah, so and I'd like to come back to that 1%. How do you get there? But you mentioned your own family is tied into this, and you talk about your grandfather's brother and in the immediate post-war years. And this is one of the things that really shocked me, is that you get a population of 3 million that gets erased. And you have a tiny fraction of that that's left. And despite that, you have massacres right after the war. So if you have a new communist regime that's trying to manipulate numbers and say that, well, as many Poles died as Jews, and they're using this as a means of building solidarity, because a lot of people see them as a kind of foreign imposed regime. Mm-hmm. They're also dealing with real circumstances on the ground. They're dealing with some horrendous massacres that are happening, that, you know, blatant, glaring examples of the kinds of things that went on during the war. And they've got to try to explain this away. I mean, how do you sweep that under the rug?
It's actually, you know, these things one can learn. I mean, Polish diplomats have been teaching this subject to their Western colleagues for many decades now. You can actually even look at the website of Polish Ministry of Foreign Affairs. They have whole sections about, you know, about this whitewash. But in any case, what happens is, so as you mentioned, after the war, you have the remnants of Polish Jews. 30,000 survive. They emerge from their hiding places where they survived, you know, by some miracle, by the help of righteous people who were among the Poles, and they emerge and they encounter a very hostile world. The problem is that people already found out that life goes on, right? And very many people, if you remove from a population 3 million citizens, I mean, their houses will not stay empty. I mean, nothing different would probably happen in Canada, right? If the house next door becomes vacant, or perhaps it's not vacant enough, perhaps you will make a contribution to make this house vacant, right? Perhaps you will denounce your Jewish neighbor, or perhaps you know you are living in his house or in her house, and you know where she hides. It's in your interest to make certain that she does not come after the war back. There are very many people with bad conscience. There are 3 million people who have been murdered, right? And there are hundreds of thousands of apartments and houses which now enjoy, let's say, new owners. And now you have this trickling of Jews who come back from the Soviet Union. So imagine people who are now learning, Poles, who learn that unfortunately their Jew survived and came back. What are you going to do? Well, part of the story is so-called Kielce pogrom. In July of 1946, you have the last huge pogrom of the survivors of the Holocaust. 40 Jews simply torn apart by a mob, driven to frenzy by legends of blood libel, that the Jews kidnapped Polish child and drew his blood for their ritual purposes. We are talking about 1946 post-Holocaust Poland. With my uncle, Samek Abrahamer, who came back from his, he was in hiding, he was then fled to Hungary. In any case, he was my great-grandfather was a very wealthy merchant in Kraków, in southern Poland. He came, so his son, my grandfather's brother, came back to take over the businesses of his father. And he was murdered he was shot through the head. And in my family, the legend, the story was the bandits did it. And actually, it was not the bandits, as I found out in the archives quite several years ago, that he and his secretary, they were shot dead by a group of patriotic members of the Polish underground who were fighting communism. And for these people, you know, Jew meant a communist. And if you killed a wealthy Jew, then even better, because you could take advantage of their wealth. And this is part of the story, because the rest of the story is that today, these people, these murderers of my family, are now hailed as heroes, as because they fought the godless communism. And so if you are anti-communist enough, you can also be a murderer of Jews. So this is the uneasy legacy of the past with which Polish state, Polish institutions, and Polish society at large does not really know how to deal. Because, I mean, you can plaster these things, you can put Band-Aid on it, but it will come out. I mean, it always comes out. These phantom pain reactions are actually very strong. It's sad even to watch, because I mean the recipe for this is very clearly, you know, available in all West European countries, where the situation was not as, of course, dramatic as in Poland. But still, you open the books. You open the books. You talk openly about this, what has happened. You don't play muzzling game. You don't try to distort history. It, hopefully, I would like to hope, it comes back with a vengeance.
So you come up with a number that around 200,000 people, which you say is a conservative number, 200,000 Jews who perished, you say, largely because of the actions or inactions of the Polish people. So where do you, how do you arrive at that number?
Oh, well, you know, it was a question of so-called microhistory. And the thing is, we'll never have precise numbers, which, and very often you, when you read the accounts of the Holocaust in the East, in the West, we have very precise numbers, because every single person, as you know, has been, who was put on the convoy number 1 through 73 in France, you will know very well who were they, which day they departed Drancy, and when they arrived at Auschwitz. And in most cases, you know whether they were selected to live or to die right away. In cases of Polish Jew, no one kept score. Nevertheless, I was very frustrated with the fact that you have many people, some did this, some did that. I wanted to move a bit beyond the sum. So what I did was a series of micro studies. I started in, well, nearly 20 years ago. I took one county, which I thought to myself as a, it was a random county with a, I chose some place with average Jewish pre-war population. Basically, I wanted to have this kind of 10% of Jews within the total mix, which would represent Polish average. And I looked at what happened to the Jews on that particular county, on the territory of that particular county. And then it is surprising how much we can learn. So if you have 3,000 people or so, as I had in their case, you can start to look at individual fates. You won't have information about all these 3,000, of course, but you will have precise, fairly firm information about several hundred. You will see how many of them have been shipped off to Bełżec extermination camp. You will see then in the in a variety of Israeli sources, in Polish sources, German sources, also countless interviews with survivors. You will find information about people who survived the initial German sweep and went into hiding. And that's where I really was looking what happened, because these people who were the 90% or 85% who were delivered to the extermination sites, we know what happened to them. And we won't have any more information because they went to gas, right? But I was trying to find out what happened to this about 10, 12% of them who went, who tried to go into hiding, went into hiding, basically who were at the mercy of their, because of the Polish neighbors. Because basically once they fled, the Germans had no idea how to detect these Jews. Without local assistance, they were blind. Germans were very few and far between. I mean, there was not, it was not a dense occupation. Poland's a large country. Germans were involved in 1942. Millions of their soldiers and policemen were for fighting on the Eastern Front. This was behind their lines. So I found out these statistics was the number, the percentage of people, of Jews who were denounced or killed by the locals. Was pointing to the fact that about 60, 70, 75% of these cases were people, were Jews who might have survived if it were not for direct or indirect Polish involvement. Now, of course, as soon as I was done with this study, accusations were thrown my way. How dare you extrapolate or make any kind of general comments regarding the entire country if you looked only at one county. And of course, well, I agreed. I said, yes, I mean, this is, I described one county, and so let's go further on. And I proposed to a group of scholars from France, Poland, Israel, and even Canada, and we looked at nine additional counties. So overall 10 counties, which is already about 10% of the counties at the time, which already starts to be something that you can. And the results were actually very much in line with what I found in the initial one. So this is an exercise in microhistory. And in my profession, history, a historian decides at a certain point when he or she thinks they know enough about the event. We'll never know everything, right? But at a certain point, we are allowed by methodology of history to say, I am in position to say that I know enough to start writing, to make certain general assumptions, even on the basis of thorough research. So this is what happened, and this is at the bottom of the of a very, very large book, a two-volume book called Night Without End, which triggered a published in Polish in 2018, in English by Indiana University Press in 2022, a shorter version. But the Polish edition triggered a wave, unprecedented wave of official hate and attack. So due to these very findings, the massive complicity, not even complicity, but collusion, I would call it rather, of Poles in settling in a tragic way the fate of their Jewish neighbors.
One of the things that struck me, so you have this conservative number of 200,000 that you say may have survived if the Poles themselves, Polish Gentiles, hadn't participated in one form or another. But you stress that you need to recognize that the situation in Poland, ground zero for the Holocaust, was very different from other countries in Europe. That you had the largest population, 3 million Jews living there. They knew what was in front of them. And it was a brutal process that the Germans went through to try to round up this population. They weren't lambs to the slaughter. But there was resistance. There were efforts to flee. Could you describe this a little bit? I mean, how, if the Germans had to go it alone, how far did they go on their own to try to pull this off? And how is it impossible for them to have achieved this on their own?
Right. I mean, the thing is that that what you have is actually is a topic which I pursue right now in my own study. And the Germans, when we have to remember that the Polish Jews, 2.5 million of them at the time in 1942, were concentrated in ghettos, in actually hundreds of ghettos. And very few of them were walled in, like Warsaw. I mean, you think ghetto, you think Warsaw, you think high walls. No, it was an exception. It was really, truly an exception. Normally, the ghettos were, their borders were sort of flimsy fences, barbed wire, something you could cross easily. And the problem is that there was not very much, and the Jews knew it. There was nowhere to go. Even if you crossed the barbed wire or the flimsy fence, you encountered a wall of hostility. And this was this tragic, most important wall, which divided the so-called ghetto from the so-called Aryan side. Now, the Germans understood that they had to introduce a degree of terror in a public space, which was truly unprecedented. What they did is basically they sent to the ghetto so-called Liquidierungskommandos, which meant liquidation commandos. Their role was to load the Jews onto the nearby, to lead them or herd them to the nearby station. We are talking about millions of people, with families, with children, We're not talking about able-bodied men who can, you know, flee. Usually you have people with commitments, with families still alive after 2.5 years of starvation, of deprivation, but still alive. So the idea is now to send these units of ghetto after ghetto after ghetto, to send the units of liquidation units, which will slaughter a part of Jewish population in situ, in these ghettos. So in other words, they show total contempt for human life, for Jewish life, and they kill Jews in the streets, en masse. So according to my counts, between, and my, many of my other colleagues, between 10 and 20% actually of Jews are being killed on the day of deportation. They never get to the wagons. The people who are herded are people who have seen every fifth or so person or every tenth person slaughtered in the streets of their town. Now, these ghettos are open, so the Poles see what's going on. The effect of these actions is absolutely crucial. Because people start to, from what I understand, this is the moment when outsiders, Poles on the outside, start to understand that Jewish life has no more value. Assisting Jews is penalty of death. So this is quite sure. Now, do you want to assist someone who in any case will be dead in a moment? And then the German system is very open-ended. So in other words, it's open to an initiative coming from bottom up. So in one area that I studied over a couple of years, actually, a small town, there will be Węgrów in northeastern Poland. There will be actually a small ghetto liquidated during one day. On September 22nd, 1942. And what happens is that people are joining in. Polish firefighters, for voluntary firefighters, they report to the Germans and they throw themselves at Jews. Of course, at the bottom, they want to steal, they want to rob, which they do with a gusto. But the thing is, this is their city, this is their town. They know every nook and cranny. And then there are people who want to look, and the Germans offer modest rewards if you report hidden Jews, because Jews are hiding. What can you do? If you can't fight them, you go into hiding. But who can hide well if your hunters know your backyard even as well as you do? So for the Germans are working on a very tight schedule. So they leave the same day in the evening or next day. These commandos leave and they go to another ghetto. Now, who remains? Basically, Polish Blue Police, which is I wrote a book recently about, a terrifying organization about which practically no research has been done prior to my own, after 80 years after the fact. People responsible for tens of thousands of Jewish deaths. And in this case, they surround the city. They surround the ghetto and they prevent Jews from fleeing to the outside. So this is a horrifying image. And in each and every step, local population is offered a possibility to make a contribution. So you have to decide, do you want to get involved? And most of these people on the Polish side who are involved, they are actually also tied to Polish resistance. And this is the horrible thing. So you have, on the one hand, you have people who are helping Germans. On the other hand, they hate the Germans because they are pursuing a different goal. They are pursuing a goal of Poland liberated of the Jews after the war. This is the way they will also explain themselves in rare cases when they are dragged to court after 1945.
And you have comments that the German authorities were kind of surprised that Poles seemed to be going beyond anything that they even had in mind.
Well, the thing is, Germans, I don't think Germans were all that generous. They were, sometimes they recognized this contribution, and we have stories about Germans, for instance, German officials complaining that they are getting so many denunciations over the post through the post office that they don't have the manpower to follow it up. But the similar situation is in France, actually. But one thing is quite certain, that without this vigilance of outsiders, of so-called Polish bystanders, as they are called, although I hotly contest this term. Without this vigilance, this presence, these 200,000 Jews had a working chance to survive. I mean, look at the other things which I describe in detail. The Germans, for instance, could not tell a Jew from non-Jew. there were very few Jews in Germany. They had no experience. Now, in Poland, Jews were very poorly assimilated, so they spoke with an accent. Their Polish was accentuated. So if you said hello, I mean, the moment I opened my mouth, you know I was not born here, right? So, and I can assure you that my English is much better than 80% of Polish Jews Polish. So the thing is, who can detect this well? Only Polish speakers. And then the question of rituals, religion, prayers in Polish, and so on. I mean, the list, in order to survive, you needed, as a Jew in hiding, simply you needed miracles.
But I think we have this Hollywood image. And we have this Hollywood image of the horrors happening behind walls, and you have a separation between what the Germans are doing and what's happening with the civilian population. But your point here is that a lot of this was just transparent, and people saw the misery and made decisions to profit. They saw opportunities within that. It's really hard to, you talk about, you know, whether you tried to, if you tried to escape from these ghettos, there wasn't far you could go. It's, you know, my own country, we talk about trying to, restore the Alcatraz prison, or creating a prison in a swamp area surrounded by alligators, because where are you going to go if you're swept up by ice? But in this case, you don't need alligators. You don't need water with sharks. You have that. You have the population that does that for you.
Right. I mean, this is extremely troubling constatation, extremely troubling conclusion, or not an argument, that this hell existed without any visible walls, and that this kind of hell has been created and grew on different ancient hates. I mean, it's not that you can press a button and people will help hate someone. There usually needs to be some kind of a longer story behind it. Anti-Semitism, you know, had, of course, these deep, very deep and ancient roots. So triggering these hates was, for Germans, actually very easy to transform simply hostility into deadly hate. But to tell you about this story a word more, there is a little place in southern Poland where today there stands a huge museum of, it's called Museum of Poles Rescuing the Jews. And it's true that there was actually a family, Polish family, that tried to rescue two Jewish families. They were denounced, by the way, by their neighbor, and all of them have been murdered by the German policemen in 1944. However, what the museum forgets to tell in this story is that in the same village, the liquidation of the Jewish community has been done without even one German being present. The Germans sent an order from a town a few miles away, and the locals did the rest. And once they deported their Jews, there were, you know, 100 of them or so, most of them fled to the forest. So what the locals started, they started hunting them down day after day, week after week, month after month, without any physical German presence. The Germans were called in only to execute people who had been caught. And so this story, what we hear in a museum in a place called Markowa, is the true, very tragic story of this wonderful, tragic Polish family that paid the highest price for their sacrifice. What you don't hear is the entire context. And this is exactly what distortion of the Holocaust is. It focuses on those good, usable parts of history and rejecting muzzling, let's say, the accounts of entire complex and horrible story that surrounded these little signs of virtue, so to say.
Okay, so I'm glad you mentioned the museum. That's a question I wanted to ask. Is, on the one hand, you say Holocaust distortion involves forgetting the participation in that past, raising the level of your suffering to that of the Jews, but it also has to do with creating this, inflating the story of the righteous. And can you explain what is that? What's the term righteous? What does that refer to? And how do museums play a major role in memorializing the righteous in Poland?
Look, so the thing is that the title Righteous Among the Nations has been created in Israel back in 1950s, and it is the highest recognition that Jewish people have created, a medal and recognition, a title for non-Jews. There are certain criteria, non-Jews who at great danger to themselves, without any opportunistic motives, saved the Jews during the Shoah. And these are very appreciated titles given out to, after a very rigorous process, given out. And this is today a sort of pride, national pride. When I was still in many, many decades ago, when I was still in Poland, no one talked much about these things because imagine this, very often people who are awarded these medals of Righteous Among the Nations ask the Israeli consul or any other authority delivering the medals to them to keep it really under wraps and not to tell anyone because they fear backlash from their own community. That was 1980s, okay, late 1970s, early 1980s, but the same thing continued until 1990s.
Was that because you didn't want to draw attention to what you did because then you're shining a spotlight on what everyone else didn't do?
Well, not only. This was more than this. It's simply the moment you were announced as a friend of the Jews, most of your village community or your town community would take a very dim view of you and your family. A few years back, when I was writing a book about one particular area, I used to visit, I'm visiting these areas. I was interviewing a lady in her 60s who was a granddaughter, actually, of a very extraordinary farmer who was trying. He didn't succeed, but he tried to save 16 Jews, four Jewish families. All of them were killed. He was severely beaten. But imagine his role. The villagers didn't like at all his involvement. So not only he was shunned after the war, but six decades later, she had to contend with hostility of her own neighbors based on that particular sin, which was extending help to Jews. The idea is, why do you do it? Well, possibly you wanted to enrich yourself because no other reason could have been possibly construed or admitted. And you were threatening entire village and the profit would only go to you. In any case, to make long story short, it's much more complicated. And without a psychological diploma, you cannot really unravel this this set of different scenarios here. So the thing, to go back to the story, you have 6,000 or 7,000 Poles who have been awarded these awards, a couple of thousand recently because of enormous pressure of the Polish state to have more and more of these medals. So very often Polish state institutions are involved in gathering testimonies in order to increase the number of medals. There's sort of a competition. The Dutch have 5,000, we have 7, so we are better. But still, these 7,000 medals or 6 before, it is seen as, you know, given the fact that you have 3 million Jews, perhaps we need more. So there is this huge pressure to inflate numbers. Now, if Israel doesn't want to give us more medals, well, we need to increase find a sort of our own medal. So there will be now a number of initiatives which will create very often from nothing heroic Poles who allegedly help the Jews. And the Polish prime minister and the president a few years back and still even today are talking about hundreds of thousands, and I quote, even millions of Poles who were righteous. Now, of course, this sounds like a joke, but it is not, because, you know, a lie repeated relentlessly finds home, finds some grateful audience, and that's what happens in Poland. And then it translates into monuments, it translates into exhibitions. One of these things which really made me very, very, very angry was the erection four years ago of a monument Treblinka. Imagine, of all places, Treblinka is the place where close to 900,000 Jews have been put to death. It is a sanctuary of Jewish suffering. A very few remain of them, but closely attached to death camps like Treblinka. So lo and behold, in 2021, Polish authorities build at Treblinka station, they build a monument to a Polish railway worker who was killed, shot there. That's true. And they say because they wanted to help the Jews, we don't have a shred of any evidence that that's what he wanted to do or did. But the monument stands. The monument stands, and now there will be, you know, Treblinka, as you know, our joint suffering, Polish and Jewish suffering. This is the official line. I called it the Polonization of Treblinka. The same thing happens in Auschwitz. Same thing happens to an extent in Sobibor. So, unfortunately, the problem is that if you control the site, if you control the geography, you control the narrative. What can you do? It's for a longer story, but unfortunately, this relentless push back of Polish memory against Jewish memory of the Shoah continues despite the change in regime. And Poland, 2 years ago, elected itself after 10 years of authoritarian right-wing rule. Poles elected centrist democratic coalition, fairly weak but democratic government. Unfortunately, in matters of Holocaust distortion, nothing really changed. I mean, historians are no longer threatened with jail terms, and I'm very grateful. And hate campaigns stimulated by the state have ceased, which is wonderful too. But in terms of the relentless drive to distort the history of the Shoah, the workings of the Institute of National Remembrance are just exactly the same as they were. The exhibitions in the museums have not seen any change. And most importantly, the school curricula do not reflect at all our state of knowledge in the field.
Because it's a unifying feel-good narrative, you know, why drop it, I guess. But to go back to your point, because earlier I mentioned you made this point that Poland finds itself as the reluctant custodian of this Holocaust past, and you have these extermination camps, and what do you do with them? Because they're universal symbols. And right. how do you manage these sites? And you're mentioning, well, it's almost like it doesn't matter the scale of the horrors of the past. There's a way to neutralize that and even to give it a positive charge. So you can take Treblinka, which maybe a lot of listeners might not know about, but Auschwitz, they more prominently featured in popular culture. You can take the worst of the sites and neutralize them. And you talk about like a sanitary corridor, sanitary belt that you can build around them. To neutralize, to change the message, you can blur the histories in a way in which you can make it part of your national story, and you can make it into a celebration of your own heroism. So how does that work at these sites?
Well, if you want, we can take this example that you mentioned, Auschwitz, because most of us heard a word or two about Auschwitz. So the thing is, how do you transform Auschwitz from a center of Jewish suffering into a center of Polish suffering or our joint suffering? This is something I will call Polonization of Auschwitz memory. So what happens at Auschwitz Museum nowadays has been going on for years. Is in fact, most of us associate Auschwitz with this iconic sign, Arbeit macht frei, right? And the red brick barracks. Now, this is actually Auschwitz I, which was a concentration camp. And you had tens of thousands of Poles who went through that particular concentration camp and were dead, were put to death were murdered, were starved to death, were beaten to death by the Nazis. And then you have a few kilometers down the road, a few miles down the road, you have Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is Auschwitz II, which is an extermination camp where 1.1 million Jews have been put to death. What you do in order to make this history a usable part, so-called S. Yehuda Bauer, a very famous Israeli historian, named it, to make this history a usable history, a history which you can use, you blend the two narratives together. In other words, you take the Auschwitz-Birkenau, Auschwitz II, with its 1.1 million Jewish victims, and you mix them together with Auschwitz I concentration camp. Now, the difference for those of you who don't know, I mean, concentration camp, the goal of a concentration camp was not death itself. It very often meant death. But in principle, concentration camp was a place of horrifyingly hard labor. Auschwitz I had factories spread around in 50-mile radius around the place where people went to work. They were tattooed on their hands. And the thing is that Jews traveling to Auschwitz were not going to Auschwitz I, they were going to Auschwitz II, and 95% of them were not going to work. They were sent right away after selection to go to gas chambers and to crematoria later on. Now, this distinction has been contested in Polish historiography forever. In 1968, the 40 members of Polish Great Encyclopedia have been fired because they dared to write that there is a difference between a concentration and extermination camp. I mean, I have to admit with certain shame that I learned that there is a difference between concentration camp and extermination camp when I started to study history when I was 18 or 19. And I lived in Poland. So this gives you an idea. Now, the result of this mixing of blending is, you know, that's what happened in Auschwitz. The Poles were killed and Jews were killed and all the other nations were killed. This is what we learn. And today, in fact, more than half of Polish citizens polled over the years say that Auschwitz is the center of Polish suffering. Now, what is even, it works. I mean, the historical distortion works very well. Even more telling is another poll that I have seen a few years back. I describe in this book, Whitewash. There is actually a poll which says which nation suffered more during this World War II, the Jews or the Poles. And imagine that in 2021 or 2022, 71% of Poles responded that Polish nation suffered equally or more than the Jews. Now, can you imagine such a result in a place where the Holocaust actually happened three generations ago? So this is what proves to us how efficient is the policy of distortion.
But that public opinion, you make a point that that public opinion changes over time. So the effectiveness of the messaging, it's not something that happens overnight. There's a lot of work and resources that are put into it, and you can actually measure it with public opinion polls.
Yes, and I mean, this particular poll has been done over 30 years. So there is the same questions have been asked, not only about the Jews and Poles and the Holocaust. I'm simply citing a part of this, which I found very pertinent. But the problem is that we are moving in an entirely wrong direction, because if you look at 30 years back, actually, many more people thought that Jews suffered more. And now, by 2020, the situation seems to be inverse.
Can you talk a little bit about, because the state, I had an episode on the memory of the genocide in Serbia. And the point that the guest made, the central point was the state has a lot of resources when it comes to the official memory calendar. And that those activists, memory activists who want to challenge that official memory, one of the things they do, at least in that case, is they come up with their own alternative memory calendar. They put their own events and dates on their own calendar to challenge how the state wants to remember the past. I don't know whether anything like that happens in Poland, but there's a powerful memory calendar that you refer to, new dates that are put on it that do a lot of work towards promoting that the narrative the state wants to get behind.
Yeah. Well, you know, the problem is that for any propaganda to be efficient, work, it has to meet some of your expectations. I mean, if you are being fed something that you dislike, you will spit it out. And the same is with bad propaganda. If you accept a narrative, a propaganda narrative, it means that at some level it touches your deeper convictions, agrees with you. It doesn't have to be the entire thing, but a part of it. Now, here what you have is the problem is that what the Holocaust distortion sells, it sells a product which is like a sweet candy. It has no value, but it tastes well. It tells people that your ancestors always held high moral ground, that our grandfathers and grandmothers behaved in a noble way, that if something happened, it's the others. And if something happens, perhaps the victims are even to blame. Now, in order to create this background, you create also, as you mentioned, these dates, these celebrations. To contest it, you need people who want to contest. I don't think there are many, actually, I know that there are not very many who would. So the kind of dates which show up. For instance, in Poland, there is a date, 14th of June of each year, which is a national day of remembrance of, it's called, the victims of concentration and extermination camps. Mind you, mind the blend, concentration and extermination camps. Why June 14th? Because on June 14th, 1940, the first transport of Polish, mostly Polish political inmates arrived at Auschwitz. Okay, so basically, who arrives at Auschwitz? Polish prisoners, political, arrive at Auschwitz. So who is basically here? Our people are, which is true. Their first transport was 80% or 85% Polish intelligentsia and political prisoners from southeastern Poland delivered to Auschwitz, to concentration camp, right? And then you have in March, you have another celebration called National Day of Remembrance, of celebration of Poles who saved the Jews. So then you have Prime Minister and President and everybody trying to praise once again ourselves, to praise our own society. So on the 14th of June, it will be us as victims. On 14th of March, it will be us as deliverers of rescue and hope. And there is more of these occasions. There are occasions which have additional meaning, but this is basically what happens. The Holocaust distortion sells its product because it is something that people want to accept.
And you're describing the signage. I mean, this is some of the things that jumped out at me. The signage that appears on the June 14th commemorative date, where Auschwitz is described as being created to exterminate the Poles. It's really blatant, kind of in your face.
It's a lie, of course.
So you have this distortion, and you mentioned that you can measure it with public opinion. So if you get to this question, well, why does it matter? So you come up with a feel-good narrative. It's, of course, you have the outrage of this distortion, the site of ground zero for the genocide. But if you look at the present politics of Poland, and you kind of hinted at this earlier, well, you have people who are, as late as the 1980s, didn't want to be recognized as among the righteous because of the anti-Semitism that still existed among their neighbors. So if you get at the question, why does it matter? I mean, clearly, if you distort that past, you perpetuate the same thinking that was at the root of what happened, right? So it doesn't go anywhere.
What you see is a dramatic move of political, let's say, normalcy to the right. In other words, things which were still unheard of 20 years ago now become part of mainstream. You can vote for, like, 1.6 million Poles voted last May for a presidential candidate who is the one that grabbed my microphone away from me. It gives you an idea that certain extraordinary violent anti-Semitic messages are no longer verboten, that this is something that actually people can, without being ashamed, admit to espouse, to support. So the price to pay for falsifying, for denying parts of own past can be huge and cruel to pay. I mean, the thing, the brutalization of political discourse is, and this is actually a phenomenon that you can see also in the United States. It's definitely in Hungary, in so many other jurisdictions, that if you take history and you start using history as a club to beat people on the head with, the results are usually easy to predict, and they are always hostile to any kind of democratic regime that we would like to see. So, as I want, and I often repeat, perhaps with this my concluding remark moving this direction, is that assault on history is never an assault on history only. Assault on history, in my mind, is an assault on basic democratic principles of our society, because one stone will trigger an avalanche. And this is so, when you see your history being, let's say, massacred by the state or by the state institutions, I'm not talking about individuals right now, it's a different story. But if your state starts to manipulate and to distort your own history, you can fear the worst in the future.
Because we're definitely going down that road in my country. Well, and you might ask, well, what's the problem with trying to have a better feel-good story? And we have the proposal to create a Garden of Heroes for the 250th anniversary of the start of the American Revolution next year. And you know, you could still have path-breaking people, members of minority groups, women, but you want to put the spotlight on the achievements, not, you know, the history that those achievements came out of, and you want to celebrate the rare individuals, not maybe the general climate or the larger context. And so it was frightening in the parallels I saw with I almost read your book as a playbook for the current administration. Like, really want to take it a step further, just take a look. And I even started reading into the Trump during his first administration, making a trip to Poland in 2017. And where does he go there? And I didn't realize, well, there's two different Warsaw monuments, one to the Warsaw Uprising, one to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And he makes a choice to go to one and not the other. And it's a political choice.
Of course. And there are so many different monuments and stories from Polish uprising and the Jewish uprising in Warsaw is one of them. But, you know, to go back to your question, when I mentioned this issue of history, assault on history being a introduction of assault of our democratic institutions and basis of democratic rule. The second thing is that this triumphant historical discourse that you find, for instance, in the States today, but also in Poland and elsewhere, this is one of the, I would call them rather primitive approaches to history, because what was eye opening when I came to Canada, actually, all these many decades ago, was that, and it's not to praise Canadian society because there are many faults with it too, of course, but what in Canadian, which is a very multicultural society, a great attempt has been made to look at Canadian history through the prism of minority experience. And I believe that this is a very good point of view, because it is a sort of a therapy against jingoistic, you know, triumphant discourse. You look at people who are basically weak and you see how mainstream majority society treats them, because this is what makes a society worth living in. It's not the way we treat the strong and the majority. It's the way what we as a majority society allow to happen to our most weak and weakest minorities and people who are left out. And whenever I hear in Poland, for instance, this absolutely enchanted cries that between World War I and II, Poland was independent, was the glorious time, I said, well, look, try to go and try to walk in the shoes of a Jewish merchant who has his head nearly blown off by rioting pogromists in 1937, and perhaps you will feel a bit different about Polish independence too. So the lesson from this book, if any, is simply to treat history with love, caution, to protect it, because if we don't, then, as there was an old Soviet joke with which I will end. The joke was that what was the logo of a Soviet travel agency? Visit Soviet Union before Soviet Union visits you. So this is the same thing about history.
Jan, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for taking time talking with me. Thank you.
I've been talking with University of Ottawa historian Jan Grabowski about his book, Whitewash, Poland and the Jews. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member, subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast app, and review us wherever you can. I'm Rick Dedarian. Thanks for listening.